From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor in Washington, and Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. Shake up in the White House. President Trump has fired his Secretary of State and wants his CIA director to replace him. Democrats win an election in the state of Pennsylvania. What might that say about the big midterm election later this year? Tension between the West and Russia are rising after a chemical weapons attack on a Russian man and his daughter in Great Britain. And the Trump administration has hit the Russians with new sanctions, retaliation, it says, for Russian cyber attacks. Let's start with the shakeup in the Trump administration. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has been fired by President Trump after just a year or so on the job, and the president has already found a replacement. Mike Pompeo, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, also known, of course, as the CIA. Tracy Wilkinson, what happened here?
Well, the removal of Tillerson had been rumored for a long time, and frankly, we thought he had weathered the storm. He was, talking about the future, planning trips. We were traveling with him. Things seemed to be going all right, but it's clear that he and President Trump clashed repeatedly on basic policy, where Tillerson was more moderate vis-a-vis Iran, North Korea, advocating diplomacy. Tillerson wanted to stay in the Iranian nuclear deal. Trump wants out of it. Those sorts of things. Repeatedly, we saw Trump undercutting Tillerson. Tillerson would be saying one thing, and Trump would come right behind him and say the opposite. And so I think it became untenable for both of them. Some people say it's surprising that Tillerson lasted as long as he did. I think the most objectionable thing in this, objectively speaking, is that is the way that Tillerson was fired via Twitter, which you don't usually do to one of the most important members of the government to be treated so shabbily. I think that's what offended a lot of people. There is dispute between the White House and the State Department over exactly when Tillerson was notified. The White House insists that John Kelly, the chief of staff, telephoned him over the weekend, notified him while he was in Africa. But his contention is, Tillerson's contention is, that he learned of it via Twitter. And that's certainly how the public learned about this dismissal.
But there's new evidence that the president himself called.
No, Tillerson. They did not speak at all until well into that day, Tuesday, I think midday. Finally, Trump called Tillerson from Air Force One on his way to California, long after he'd spoken about it on the White House lawn, long after the tweet.
You know, it's important to remember that the Secretary of State is fourth in line with succession for the presidency. I mean, a very big job. But beyond that, Michael, he was really seen as one of the few remaining moderate voices in this White House. The president, just the week before, of course, said goodbye to his chief economic advisor, Gary Cohn, who was also seen, at least in economic terms, as a voice of moderation. So the president is now kind of purging his government, if you will, of these more mainstream, middle of the line of voices. With that in mind, tell us about Mike Pompeo.
Mike Pompeo, and to go back to Rex Tillerson, though, just for a moment, I want to say that, yes, I agree with you that this is, Tracy, that this is someone who we're all surprised that he lasted this long because of all the conflict. I mean, he called the president a very pejorative name last summer, which would have gotten anybody else fired on the spot. I mean, when you talk about the circumstances for the firing, it's not only the way that he was fired by Twitter, it's the coincidence that he took a strong stance against Russia in a simultaneous occurrence with his firing. So it doesn't really give a clear picture of why he was fired. Was he fired because of the long line on the long list of conflicts that he had with the president, or for just this one act of defiance against speaking out against Russia? With that said, Mike Pompeo is currently the director of the CIA, as you mentioned. He is a very accomplished man, a very intelligent man. He is a Harvard Law Review. He is, I believe, first in his class from West Point, the U.S. Military Academy, has been in the U.S. Congress. He is a guy who was people were skeptical of when he first came into the CIA, but he has been really accepted by that intelligence community, by all accounts. He's a very gung-ho type of guy. It's the sort of personality that that group of people really accepts and gets into. He respects what they do. They respect how he has gone about his work. So it's been a fairly good match there. He's also been his number one asset, I believe, is his ability to get along with the president. And in this administration, when you talk about the purge of moderates, it's also a purge of people who do not think in lockstep with the president. If you don't get him, if you don't understand how he thinks, if you don't understand how he wants to absorb information, you're not going to be able to be effective in this administration. Now, here's a guy who's never had served a single day in government other than president of the United States. He's never run a large company. He has his own way of doing things. And Mike Pompeo has tapped into that somehow.
But now beyond that, the relationship that the two of them have, what does that mean for a policy? Mike Pompeo, of course, is regarded as a hardliner on issues like North Korea and Iran. Looking at those two principal issues, what's going to happen with those two problems going forward?
Going into these negotiations with North Korea in advance of talks that are meant to be happening. We don't know, in fact, if they actually will, but the talks are meant to be happening. Mike Pompeo is much more of a hardliner. He's much more of a militaristic bent than Rex Tillerson. Even though Rex Tillerson was not a professional diplomat, I believe that he did feel that diplomacy was the right and calling of the State Department. I think that Mike Pompeo is much more militaristic and much more aggressive in his stance towards North Korea and his stance towards Iran. So I think that this is the direction that the president had been wanting to take. And again, it puts him in a much more, it's a congenial, if you will, mode with President Trump.
Tracy, quickly on this issue, what does it mean for Iran and
I think this is the end of the Iran deal. Think that, for a long time, Pompeo, as a congressman before, and even as recently as last year at the Aspen Institute, he has talked about getting out of the deal. He's talked about, at one point, even bombing Iran's nuclear facilities. That was a few years ago, but still, he is much more hawkish on Iran than Tillerson ever was, and even more so than Trump, I think. So I think this probably spells the end of the U.S. participation in the nuclear deal with Iran.
It's worth pointing out quickly before we move on that a lot of people seem to think that this is sort of a U.S.-Iran deal. Well, it's not. It's part of what's called P5+1 agreement, meaning that it's the United States, Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany agreement with Iran. And those other countries have said, we're not going to renegotiate this. It's as good as we were able to get. So what's going to happen in terms of all these other countries?
It's a dilemma. A lot of the Europeans have been in town the last couple of weeks trying to lobby the administration, trying to find alternative ways to fix it, in quotation marks, as Trump always says, fix this. But there's no way to fix it that will satisfy Trump. That's what a lot of the Europeans have concluded. So they're sticking with the deal. And the problem is that, as a diplomat I quoted today said, if the U.S. walks, we walk alone. And it will be Iran then. How do they respond? That's the next big question, because they could see this as an invitation to resume nuclear power production, especially if the U.S. puts sanctions back in place, which presumably it would.
All right. Well, moving on closer at home here, some of our listeners around the world might not know that the House of Representatives, which is the lower chamber of our Congress, has 435 members. We just had a special election this week to fill one of those seats from the state of Pennsylvania. This was in an area that President Trump won handily in 2016, and yet a Democrat won this narrowly, but nevertheless, a Democrat won. Michael, what happened here?
This is the Pennsylvania 18th district, I believe, which is a district that, as you say, President Trump won by, I believe, 20 points, something like that, really handily won that. And you had a candidate on the Democratic side, Connor Lamb, who is an attorney, long record of public service, also beyond his
Marine veteran, too.
Marine veteran, yeah. This was really a very, very solid candidate in a lot of ways as a person. You know, his resume is very solid. But what really stood out was that his resume went along with his local values, if you will. This time, there was a Democrat who ran as a local Democrat, not as a national Democrat, if you will. He wasn't standing so much on the party's most recent fervent stands about immigration, about abortion, about gun control. He is a gun owner who feels that there should be universal background checks. He is a person who's personally opposed to abortion, but said he respects a woman's right to choose. He said a lot of the right things that we used to hear a lot from what we used to call a centrist Democrat. And we haven't seen one of those for such a long time. It was like the appearance of a unicorn or something. So people didn't know what to call it. The Republicans, while the election was being held, were saying that this was a typical Democrat who was in lockstep with House Leader Nancy Pelosi, and he would be extremely liberal in terms of his views and his positions and his stances once he won the seat, by a very slim margin, mind you, but he did win the seat. They were saying that he was a guy who ran because he ran as a conservative. He ran as a Republican. Donald Trump said in a fundraiser that he ran because he supported everything that Donald Trump supports, which is not true. He did not do that. What he is a centrist Democrat, and I think it gives a signal to the rest of the Democratic Party as we head into the midterm elections. Run local. Don't run national. Run and represent the people that are in your district. This was a victory for that local party and that local district.
So the old adage that politics is local perhaps could be back based on what you're saying, Michael. Tracy, as we mentioned, national elections coming up in November, though the entire House and one-third of the Senate, the upper chamber of our Congress, also up for re-election in November. Is it too much to say that that this is kind of foreshadowing for what could happen in November? What's the outlook for November at this point?
Well, it's hard to say that it foreshadows what will happen there. It's still a long way out, and many things could happen. But I do think, as Michael said, the lesson for the Democrats is, you know, emphasize local issues. The lesson for Republicans is the tax cuts perhaps are not having as much resonance with voters as the GOP is counting on. That certainly didn't seem to be the case in Pennsylvania. So that's a lesson they're going to have to deal with between now and November.
All right. Well, let's take a short break. More issues in the news in just a moment.
This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. A reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor in Washington, and Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. Tensions between the West and Russia are rising after a nerve gas attack on a Russian man and his daughter in Great Britain. The British, the U.S., France, and Germany now blame Moscow for this. The Russians deny it. Here's what the White House, in fact, said this week, quote, "We share the U.K. assessment that there is no plausible alternative explanation, and note that Russia's failure to address the legitimate request by the U.K. government further undermines its responsibility." Tracy, who is this Russian man who was attacked, and why was he attacked?
He was a double agent. So he had been a Soviet spy for years and then had crossed over and was working for the West. He was in England with his daughter, I think taking a holiday, and they had gone to a pizzeria and then ended up on a park bench sick from a nerve agent that the British government says was developed by the Soviet, you know, then Soviet military, Russian military. I think what's interesting in this case is how long it took the U.S. to condemn this. The day that Theresa May came out and very vociferously denounced Russia, Sarah Sanders was still sort of hedging. And then it was actually, I think, 2 or 3 days before President Trump said anything, and then he didn't really condemn Vladimir Putin at all, just said, well, it looks like Russia did this kind of thing. And so it's, again, more evidence of the reluctance that this administration, for whatever reason, has in criticizing Russia.
And why is that, you think?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I think President Trump genuinely admires Putin as a strong man. He seems to have a soft spot for the autocrats of the world. Are there more nefarious reasons? You know, I guess we'll have to wait for Robert Mueller to tell us that.
Okay, that, of course, is the special counsel who's looking into this alleged wrongdoing or collusion, if you will, between the Trump campaign and the Russians. So far, no solid evidence. It's fair to note that that has occurred, but the investigation rolls on. Now, Michael, this nerve agent attack on British soil, some might say that that's an act of terrorism against Britain. Others might even call it worse, an act of war, I've read. Well, how would you characterize something like this?
Well, I'd say more importantly, how does our military and how does our intelligence community characterize it? And they are condemning it in no uncertain terms right down the line. H.R. McMaster has been very, very vocal in his condemnation of this act, calling it an egregious act.
That, of course, is the National Security,
Security Advisor, the embattled National Security Advisor, maybe partially because, in that embattled condition, partially because of his statement so strongly against this Russian act. It is unclear what Vladimir Putin expects to gain by something that is this blatant and this bold. I have been talking to a number of people, and I haven't got, in my mind, something that really makes it worthwhile. And right now, the response has been what you would expect for an act like this. There's been sanctions put in place, finally, by the U.S., and there's been an expulsion of diplomats from the U.K. This is maybe Theresa May's finest hour, by the way. She's performed brilliantly in this role after floundering somewhat with the whole Brexit issue. She's really performed brilliantly. But the issue is, what happens now? Do we have actions taken by the United Nations Security Council? Will there be actions taken by NATO? This occurred on the soil of a NATO partner, and NATO has provisions for taking retaliatory steps. So up until now, even Putin himself has said that, number one, he denies it. Number two, nobody cares about what has happened so far. It hasn't been effective in deterring future acts. So along with outrage, will there be actual offensive steps, aggression taken against Russia for something that is this, again, egregious as an act?
Well, given that the Russians have veto power in the U.N. Security Council, what on earth could the U.N. do?
In the U.N., probably nothing more, again, than the symbolic and sort of ritual outrage that comes, statements and the like. But NATO, that's a different story.
Yeah, NATO's a different story. And it's important to note the expulsion of 23 Russian diplomats from the U.K., that's nearly half of their entire diplomatic mission. So it's quite significant. And I would add, the sanctions that the United States finally put in place this week were not in response to that attack. They were actually in response to the election meddling. These are sanctions that Congress voted almost unanimously on last year, and it's taken this long for the Trump administration to finally impose them.
We're going to get to that in just a second. In your view, Tracy, why are the Russians being so aggressive here? It's not just the alleged attack on this Russian spy and his daughter, but there's a whole long list of other incidents that Putin has allegedly been involved with. I mean, everything from the shooting down of the airliner over Ukraine, I think a couple of years ago, the attacks on journalists journalists in Russia, opponents abroad, and this kind of thing. Up to this point, Putin has really not been stopped at all with these things.
That's correct. Meddling in elections throughout Europe, the Balkans, former Soviet republics, obviously the annexation of Crimea, the invasion or military actions against Ukraine and other neighbors. He has not been punished, and he uses these actions to rally domestic support for himself and to show that he is strong and to show that Russia is back on the rise, is becoming a global player again, and in some ways stepping into a vacuum created by the United States pulling back from a lot of these areas and leaving a void. And so I think he's just taking advantage of what he sees as an opportunity to exert Russian power and his own power.
And Putin, of course, is a big election coming up in Russia. There's no question that he is going to win, of course.
Well, he managed to disqualify one of the main opponents, so I think you can put money on his victory Sunday.
All right. Let's stay on Russia for just a second. I think, Tracy, you alluded to this. These sanctions that the United States this week unveiled against the Russians, long time in the making, for what the White House calls cyber attacks, not just on the United States, not simply for meddling in the 2016 election, but for cyber attacks on other countries as well. What specifically are these sanctions, and in your judgment, how effective will they be?
Well, one of the other alleged crimes is attacking, using cyber attacks on U.S. electrical grids and power and water systems, which, you know, then you're talking about the infrastructure, the physical infrastructure of the country, and that's really quite dangerous. The sanctions mean that certain Russian businesses, especially in the oil sector, cannot do business with U.S. entities, U.S. banks, that sort of thing. Any assets that any of the named targets in the sanctions might have in the U.S. Would be frozen. You know, sanctions, it's a big debate how effective they really are. We've seen sanctions after sanctions after sanctions imposed against North Korea, and North Korea has been hurt, but it hasn't stopped its nuclear production at all. In Iran, the sanctions were having a big impact on the economy, and it's part of what drove Iran to negotiate that nuclear treaty. You know, through history, sanctions in South Africa ultimately had an effect, but it took a long time. The United States has steadily been perfecting its ability to issue sanctions. We see them against Mexican drug cartels, kingpins. So they do have an impact. Whether they really can stop bad behavior, I think that's still a big debate, and we see too many instances when they don't.
And I'd also just like to say that the sanctions really depend on cooperation between nations. You know, sort of unilateral sanctions can be a very limited success. But when you have partnerships, when you have alliances that create a number of countries exerting that type of economic pressure simultaneously, that's when they're most effective. And again, as the U.S. tends to pull out of these types of agreements, that's where you have this sort of give and take over wanting to have these unilateral deals that make America great again, in quotes, but also lessen the U.S. influence in roles where you need to have a group of people coming to the table together to make a difference.
The thing that I find scary about this, and I'd like both of you to weigh in on this, is something that Tracy alluded to, the fact that the Russians have apparently, according to the U.S. government, planted a malware in our energy grid, power plants, and that kind of thing. Possibly they could sabotage our power systems, which certainly sounds to me like an act of war. If you were to bomb those things, that would be an act of war. If you were to sabotage them electronically, would that not be the same thing? Do you think people are focusing enough on this kind of thing? That's serious business.
When you say people, the general public, no, because it's not as spectacular as an explosion. But when you're talking about cyber attacks and things like this, the people who are behind the scenes are very much concerned about them because they can be very much more effective and very much more quickly effective to simultaneously be able to shut down huge swaths of the United States power grid or the flow of oil or anything that's involved with infrastructure is a hugely threatening thing. And those in the intelligence community are very, very concerned about it. And I think that's where they want the Trump administration to stand up and be very forceful against any type of interference in that way from Russia or any other entity.
And it's not just the power grid, of course. There are concerns about possible cyber attacks on everything from transportation networks, communication systems. I mean, you name it, financial markets, all sorts of things. And the concern, Tracy, is that the so-called a cyber 9/11 kind of attack could occur in this country.
Yeah, it's terrifying, the possible repercussions. And as Michael said, it's harder to see. It's more insidious. And so that makes it harder to attack and confront, at least in the public sphere. And, you know, again, the tone is set at the top where a president doesn't seem concerned about it. He belittles the intelligence community at times when they come up with these assessments. And so there is definitely a lack of attention being focused, not just in the public, but in Congress. You know, Congress has not done anything either to really move to protect the United States against cyber attacks.
I will have to end it right there. Thanks to Tracy Wilkinson of the Los Angeles Times and Michael Williams of CBS News. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you very much for listening.